Tonight I'm going to talk about joy. I actually talked about this about 6 months ago, but it was requested that I talk about it again. I made an outrageous statement in the last Dharma talk that joy is part of our birthright. And I was pushed on that, and so hence this Dharma talk. And I'll begin with what I'm going to call an odd thought experiment, a two-part thought experiment. And part one of it is, let's just for the sake of argument, imagine that the Buddhist story is totally true, 100% true, you know, the reincarnation, the Buddhist teaching, all that 100% true. Now, of course, Buddhism itself is not terribly attached to the truth of its own story, but let's just say that the Buddhist story is completely true. Part two of this thought experiment has to do with the nature of our universe. Let's assume that we know that we live in a galaxy, one of billions of galaxies, and all these galaxies have hundreds of billions of stars, many of which have planets. Let's just assume that this universe is teeming with intelligent life. We don't know that for sure, but let's just assume that there are endless civilizations of intelligent life out there. And so what that would mean is that, of course, the Buddha has appeared in all those worlds and has appeared as one of those species and all those species and has given his teachings. And it also means that in the great cycle of reincarnation, we could be reincarnated in any of those places. And so in that perspective, what does it mean to be human? In that perspective, what might we as souls have been choosing to choose to be human as opposed to billions of other options? And it's striking that there are some things about being human, about having a mammal body and a mammal brain. There are some things that accord very nicely with Buddhism. Principally, we're wired for connection. And so when we're connected to others, when I'm acting from a place of compassion and patience and forgiveness and generosity and that sort of thing, it feels good, you know? And so there's this sort of natural biological resonance with the Buddha's teachings along those lines. One of the things that is much more problematic from the point of view of Buddhism is what happens with attention and desire in our mind. First of all, we're very easily distracted. And in fact, in some ways, it feels good to be distracted, you know, sort of this paradox of what it is to be human. We have a multi-million-dollar industry, the entertainment industry, that essentially is designed to distract us from ourselves, you know. And I don't want to paint entertainment as completely evil. I would say that entertainment, I think it's a lot like, say, chocolate, you know. You have chocolate once or twice a week, that's not a problem. But if I'm eating tons and tons of chocolate every single day of my life, that's a problem. We have a hard time focusing, and there's something rewarding. Our minds are pulled away by thoughts of pleasure, pulled away by thoughts of fear. Novelty holds a tremendous fascination for us. Anything that is new, you know, chasing after something new stimulates the pleasure centers of the brain. And so, you know, of course, this, among other things, this makes us incredibly manipulative, you know, that every time, say, Apple, you know, launches a new phone, people line up around the block because they want to have the excitement of having the new thing, you know, this sort of thing. Part of what is tricky about the human brain also along these lines is the way the human, what's going on in our visual field impacts us. And what I mean by that is, if you imagine, say, 40,000 years ago, you know, prehistoric times, people were living in nature. And when you're in nature all the time, mostly what you see are gentle visual landscapes, you know, for the vast majority of the time. And then suddenly, if there's a vast amount of movement in one part of your visual field, you would orient to that. What's going on there? You know, that sort of thing. And so when there's change in our visual field, rapid change in our visual field, it orients our attention. It gives us a pulse of adrenaline. It prepares us for what might be a threat. Well, of course, anything like an action movie or TVs or video games, essentially that's constantly changing the visual field. So that's giving a constant feed of adrenaline. And so it's addictive in a way because adrenaline feels good, but it's stressing out the entire body, you know, and it's actually taking us further and further away from a place where we can be peaceful and happy. I think it's sad in this, one of the sad things about our current society is that people confuse excitement for happiness. You know, and excitement is in many ways a temporary thrill and then it's gone, you know, unlike abiding happiness. And excitement also runs on the same circuitry as stress. And so if I'm pursuing a life of excitement, essentially I'm practicing how to have stress, you know. And this is another feature of our brains, of our mammalian brains. Everything that is not under our conscious control, it's what's called the autonomic nervous system. And this is divided into two halves, the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system. The sympathetic nervous system is the fight or flight response. It revs us up. It's the stress response. This is what is stimulated by watching, you know, pretty much by watching all TV or playing video games. And it's very, how can I say, this system was designed to prepare us for emergencies, you know, for the moment that out in nature that we encountered the wild animal and I would have to actually fight or flee. And so it's part of the function of the sympathetic nervous system to shut down immune function, to shut down digestive function. Those things don't matter when I'm facing a tiger, you know. It makes the thinking very black and white. And so it's really an emergency situation. And in the natural world, we would only be in that state a short time. And then we'd go back to being relaxed most of the time. And that's what the body is designed to do, to be in relaxation most of the time. And the strange thing about the world in which we live now is most people, most of the time or all of the time, are in sympathetic arousal. They're in the stressed, amped up nervous system, which has tremendously negative long-term health effects. And most people don't even know how to relax. And so part of the whole conversation about joy or happiness, like step one is just to get as happy as our ancestors 40,000 years ago were most of the time. You know, like that would be doing really good by modern standards, you see. And what that would involve is unplugging as much as possible. It would involve breathing deeply, spending time in nature, spending time connecting with people, you know, practicing relaxing, making space and setting an intention around holding a relaxed frame and just relaxing throughout mind and body. And there's tremendous amount of joy that just comes simply from relaxing into life, relaxing into the body. another feature of our, at least modern America. America is a very head-centered culture. We spend a lot of time in our head. A good way to be miserable is to spend a lot of time in your head. When we're more in our body, we can be more present to the sensual experience of the world. The colors, the textures, the smells, just the feeling of fresh air on the body, the feeling of walking in sunshine, all these very subtle kinds of sensations. And when you're relaxed enough and calm enough, you can take these in. Along these lines, another important strand of happiness is attention. And in fact, I regard this as one of the fundamental insights of Buddhism. Essentially, Buddhism says if you want to be happy, you need to pay attention, you know. Our ability to focus, our ability to cultivate attention and to refine the quality of our attention is very important for our happiness. It's funny, people don't often think about the quality of our attention. We're so attention-starved in this society. It's just basically, are you paying attention or not, you know? And it's not even about what is the depth of the attention. And so in some sense, all of that is, you might say, a prelude to a real conversation about joy. Buddhism talks about the four illimitable mind states: love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. These are four mind states without limits because they take us beyond the limits of ego. And much as love and compassion are in some ways two sides of the same coin, joy and equanimity also have this deep connection. Equanimity is simply resting and being at peace with what is. And when we rest and we're at peace with life as it is, there's a simple joy simply in experiencing the world as it is. You might say a joy of resting in pure awareness. And pure awareness is, ultimately, our Buddha nature. Joy is an illimitable mind. It is a mind state beyond limit. Because to open fully into joy, to relax fully into joy, means that I have to give up a lot of my ego preferences. I have to give up, you know, well, but I like this, I don't like this, you know, this, you know, the way the ego is constantly in this, you know, pulling some things and pushing other things away, you know. To some extent, it's about dropping that so that we can step into joy more fully. And that joy is always there. It's how can I say? It is 1,000 miles from where our modern culture tends to put us, but it is always nearer than breathing, closer than hands and feet. And that's the paradox. So at this point, I'm going to put the quote sheet in the chat. The top quote is from Mencius, Mengzi. Mengzi was the number two guy in the Confucian tradition. He was he's called in China the second sage after Confucius himself. And Mengzi said quite simply, "The great man does not lose his childlike heart." And that is just such a profound quote at so many levels that just our own capacity for innocence and wonder is part of our greatness. Rumi said quite simply, when you do things from your soul, you feel a river moving in you, a joy. So true. The one from Hafez I had last week, but it's such a great quote that I included it again. Ever since happiness heard your name, it has been running through the streets trying to find you. Love that image of happiness running through the streets trying to find me. Julia Margaret Cameron said, the capacity for delight is the gift of paying attention. Gandhi said, happiness is when what you think, what you say, and what you do are in harmony. This kind of deep coherence of everything that we are, this sort of life-encompassing integrity. Thierry Desjardins says, joy is the most infallible sign of the presence of God. And it's true. I mean, I've certainly have had the pleasure of being among people who have done a lot of work on themselves, and there's just this radiant joy that they have. It's incredible. You cannot feel bad when you're in the presence of these people. Henry Miller says, the moment one gives close attention to anything, even a blade of grass, it becomes mysterious, awesome, and indescribably magnificent world in itself. One of my favorite quotes from Wei Wu Wei, why are you unhappy? Because 99.9% of everything you think and everything you do is for yourself, and there isn't one. That really gets to the heart of joy as one of the mind states that goes beyond limits of ego. Thomas Merton says, by being attentive, by learning to listen or recovering the natural capacity to listen, which cannot be learned any more than breathing, we can find ourselves engulfed in such happiness that it cannot be explained. The happiness of being at one with everything in that hidden ground of love for which there can be no explanation. Thich Nhat Hanh says quite simply, the present moment is filled with joy and happiness. If you are attentive, you will see it. The Jungian analyst Marion Woodman said, this is your body, your greatest gift, pregnant with wisdom that you do not hear, grief you thought that was forgotten, and joy you have never known. And it's so true. All of us have so much to learn about the wisdom that is in our bodies. Susan Sontag said, do stuff, be clenched, curious, not waiting for inspiration shove or society's kiss on your forehead. It's about paying attention. Attention is vitality. It connects you with others. It makes you eager. Stay eager. The Dalai Lama says, I believe compassion to be one of the few things we can practice that will bring immediate and long-term happiness to our lives. And it is absolutely true that love and compassion are some of the surest ways to have more joy in our lives. Mary Oliver said, this is the first, wildest, and wisest thing I know, that the soul exists and that it is built entirely out of attention. And she also said, I would like to do whatever it is that presses the essence from the hours. Angelus Ariane says, four rules of life. Show up, pay attention to what has heart and meaning for you. Speak your truth without blame or judgment. Be open to outcome, not attached to outcome. Jack Kornfield said, I saw the whole idea of spiritual renunciation as a kind of joke, trying to make oneself let go of ordinary life and pleasures. In fact, nirvana is so open and joyful, it is so much more than any of the small pleasures we grasp after. You don't renounce the world, you gain the world. He also said, the aim of spiritual life is to awaken a joyful freedom, a benevolent and compassionate heart in spite of everything. Paul Coelho says, you can become blind by seeing each day as a similar one. Each day is a different day. Each day is a miracle of its own. It's just a matter of paying attention to this miracle. Eckhart Tolle says, on a deeper level, you are already complete. When you realize that, there is a playful, joyful energy behind what you do. Tara Brach said, there is something wonderfully bold and liberating about saying yes to our entire imperfect and messy life. Anne Lamott says, there is ecstasy in, I think that should be in paying attention. There's ecstasy in paying attention. You can get into a kind of Wordsworthian openness to the world where you see everything as the essence of holiness. And incidentally, Wordsworth's poetry is also extraordinary in this regard. Brené Brown says, I don't have to chase extraordinary moments to find happiness. It's right in front of me if I'm paying attention and practicing gratitude. Miranda July says, you give into distractions as if it is a murder. You lay there waiting to be killed. Today, fight for your life. And Mark and Angel Chernoff says, when you are no longer able to change the situation, you are challenged to change yourself. And that changes everything.